Columbus Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a dream about hibernation.
Some animals hibernate to survive the winter. Humans aren't included in that group, but that hasn't stopped writer Krista Eastman from imagining her perfect winter abode.
Before natural historians understood that some birds fly thousands of miles south each winter, they looked for other ways to explain their disappearance. Birds were like snakes, they suggested, burrowing for themselves a hibernaculum, an earthy pocket in which to pass the winter. Under the ground, the robin slumbered, her heart beating once in a while, her open throat not tweeting at all, her feathers caked in grit. This was another way to survive the winter, digging in, admitting no one, waiting for this too to pass. Deep into the winter blues, I awake to early morning darkness and wonder, is there really no other place for people and animals to live? Is there no other way? Some people are practical in coping with the season. Swift in booking cheap flights to Florida, they do not hesitate, they do not dally, they just depart. I am a member of that other tribe, those who dig in, those who let their thoughts grow warped on the grayest light of winter. At some point, usually around January 14th, I surrender to the season. My most insignificant problems begin to appear to me as uncontainable irritations, crosswords I'm much too grumpy to solve. It's hard, then, not to fantasize about my own hibernaculum, how I'd stock mine with a 5-month supply of coffee, chocolate, cheese, and wine to be consumed in that order every day, all winter long. Add to that a pile of books and a landline that only dials out for delivery. This would be the season of slow and silent contemplation, moderate melancholy, little to no exercise. A wise friend of mine claims this is what winter is for, a natural slowing down, a time to reflect, a not-so-unhealthy space for feeling a little bit sad. If it were possible, I think I'd also loft my hibernaculum in a tree and make of it a warm and protected nest. And then I'd also probably appoint someone responsible for yanking open the nest trap door once spring had truly come. I'd fall to the ground in an unwashed heap, stand up, blink my eyes. I imagined then that my pitying neighbors would gather round to watch as I stood for the first time in months, stretching muscles, cracking joints. She smells even worse than last year, one of them might mutter, as I crab walk off to the lake for a bracing spring rinse. But I won't do any of that, of course, not really. I will climb out of bed when my son wakes each morning. I will be on time for work. I will remember to bring home that carton of eggs. But someday I will also emerge vainglorious from winter's pocket. It will be suddenly warm and I will be suddenly awake, and soon, my naked ankles frisky from sun, I'll wonder, what could be better than here? What way is there but this?
Krista Eastman's essays have appeared in the Georgia Review, the Kenyon Review, and other journals. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. For more information, visit our website at wisconsinlife.org and find us on Facebook and on Twitter. I'm Maureen McCollum.
This is Central Time. Now, four candidates are running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. The outcome of the April general election could shift the ideological balance of the court, which is widely seen as having a 4-3 conservative majority in the current lineup. Before the primary election on February 21st, we invited all the candidates to join us to talk about the race. We're going to talk with two of them today. Daniel Kelly served as a state Supreme Court justice from 2016 until 2020 and is now running for a new term. Justice Kelly, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
Can you give us your brief elevator pitch about your case for being back on the court?
Sure. I think it starts where it has to start, with my service on the Supreme Court. It was the greatest professional honor of a lifetime to serve the people of Wisconsin as one of their Supreme Court justices. I loved every moment of it, and I especially loved the relationship between the people of Wisconsin and me. That's servant and boss. So I understood that all the authority that I exercised belonged to them, so I was serving them as my bosses during that entire time. Now, the work that I've done on the Supreme Court, I've written several landmark opinions on constitutional matters, and the body of my work has been quoted, cited, or relied upon hundreds of times by courts here in Wisconsin and across the country. And so as I've traveled in the state of Wisconsin, I've listened to what folks have told me, and they tell me they want to make sure that the next Supreme Court justice has a long public record of fidelity to the original public meaning of the Constitution. And they say they see that in me, and so they asked me to run, and I've accepted their kind offer to run.
Now, a lot of times voters might look at a court race and treat it like a political race. We want candidates who go with the policies we like, the outcomes we like. You are making the case that voters shouldn't do that. What do you hope they look at instead?
Yeah, so we have the court is a non-political branch. All the political questions are to be decided in the legislature, not in the courts. So the way that we do the job to ensure that we are faithful to the Constitution of the people of Wisconsin is a methodology that I followed my entire time on the court. And that is you start with the law, and whether it's a constitutional provision, statute, regulation, or common law, and then you use rigorous logic to move from that all the way down to the conclusion. And when you're done, you should be able to look back and see an unbroken chain of logic between the conclusion and the premises, the law. And if you do, that's your guarantee that the conclusion is commanded by law and has not been affected by any personal values or politics.
So when people ask you about particular issues, redistricting or abortion, what do you say to them?
I say the same boring thing that I do every single time. I will decide those cases the same way I've decided all cases on the Supreme Court, according to what the law commands. In fact, the other day I was promising people that one of my superpowers is to be boring, and that I am running to be the most boring member of the Supreme Court and in the state's entire history, because the role of the court does not change depending on what type of issue or which particular issue it's addressing. Is always the same. Take the law that already exists and apply that to resolve the case without respect to your personal values or politics, and you do that today, and then you do the same thing tomorrow, and the day after that, ad infinitum. Every single day, the job is exactly the same without regard to the issue before you.
Your campaign put out a press release with the title, Justice Kelly is the only candidate endorsed by all three Wisconsin pro-life groups. Now, you can't control who endorses you, of course, but does it make a statement to voters, sharing that with the public, that they might expect you to vote a particular way on pro-life and or abortion issues?
Well, I don't think so. If they look carefully at the endorsement. So those organizations, the conversation I had with them was that they want a justice who follows the law, who is faithful to the original public meaning of the Constitution, faithful to the terms of the statute that people have adopted, and that's what they're looking for. They haven't asked me to rule in any particular way on any particular issue. All they want is to be able to address issues in the constitutional manner, to resolve political questions in the legislature and resolve legal questions in the court.
The perception, though, is, you know, people refer to the conservative justices, the liberal justices, voting on high-profile issues often, not always, but often plays out that way. Really, they're not politicians in robes once they hit the Supreme Court?
Well, I'm not. And I think each individual justice is responsible for answering to the Constitution's call to be impartial, to set aside your personal politics and just do the work of the court. And that's what I've done. And I invite all jurists, whether on the Supreme Court or the Court of Appeals or the Circuit Court, to do the exact same thing. Don't allow your personal values or politics influence the work of the court. If we allow that, that's where people's confidence and trust in the judiciary starts to fail. And if we allow that to start to fail, people will question whether justice is available in our courts. And so this methodology that I have of careful and precise logic in applying the law to resolve cases is meant to not only be faithful to the Constitution and the people of Wisconsin, but to engender in them confidence that, justice can be found, and it can be found in Wisconsin courts.
Once in a great while, an issue comes up where at least some members of the public or one party or another say this particular justice should recuse him or herself from this case. What do you think are the right standards for recusal of state Supreme Court justices?
Well, I think any time that there's a circumstance in which a jurist is not completely confident that he can decide the case in front of him without being unduly influenced by a contribution, by a relationship, by any other factor, that person should recuse him or herself. One of the responsibilities of a jurist is not only to be impartial in fact, but also to project that impartiality in appearance. And so when there are circumstances where a reasonable person just would not be confident that the court, that the jurist is going to decide the case according to the law, that's something that the jurist should seriously take into account in making a recusal decision.
We hope for a civility on the court amongst the justices. There have been moments on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court where it didn't always work out so well. What would your approach to be to a collegial relationship?
Yeah, that's a great question. It was one that I was asked when I first joined the court. And my answer today is the same as it was then. And it's the way I've tried to conduct myself in all collegial atmospheres. And that involves you walk humbly, you love unconditionally, and you speak the soft word that turns away wrath. And if you can do that, you can have productive and civil conversations with anyone on any subject.
Justice Kelly, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Daniel Kelly served as a state Supreme Court justice from 2016 until 2020. Now he's one of four candidates running for an open seat on the state Supreme Court. In just a moment, we'll meet another contender in that race. That's up next on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk with candidates for the state Supreme Court ahead of the primary election on February 21st. Janet Protasiewicz joins us now. She's a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge and a former prosecutor. Judge Protasiewicz, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
Can you start with your elevator pitch, a half a minute or so, on why you're running for the state's highest court?
Did you say 2 hours or a half a minute? The reason I'm running for the state Supreme Court is to bring back change and common sense to our court. I'm a follow-the-law, common-sense judge, not an uber-partisan. There has been so much extreme partisanship on our Wisconsin Supreme Court, and that's why I'm running.
As political groups and interest groups line up, they view you as a liberal, those who support you, those who oppose you. What would you say to them?
I would say that, you know, labels are interesting and that, yes, I am very, very progressive when it comes to social issues. But I would also say that there are issues that, quite frankly, you know, go across all party lines, such as community safety, such as a judicial philosophy, such as being a fair jurist, such as being not a partisan, such as not having a thumb on the scale when it comes to issues that are going to come before the Supreme Court, such as not being an activist judge. You know, we need common sense. We don't need extreme partisanship, and I will root every decision in the law.
One decision or one case likely to come before the state Supreme Court, again, is the state's election maps. You've described the current maps and the system that created them unfavorably. Could, say, Republicans, if this case came before you as a Supreme Court justice, count on you to not have your thumb on the scale?
Absolutely. I said that the maps are rigged. And, you know, Wisconsin's a battleground state. I don't think you could sell to any rational person that the maps are fair. You just look at them with the numbers in the Wisconsin State Senate, the numbers in the Wisconsin State Assembly. You just look at those numbers, you know, when you know that something is wrong. But what I have told everyone, while I state that those maps are rigged and while I talk about some of the other issues that are important to both me and all Wisconsinites, is that all of my decisions are going to be, you know, rooted in the law, that I plan to follow the law, that I tell you what my values are, because I think that Supreme Court candidates should share with the community and the electorate what their values are. But nonetheless, I will uphold the law, follow the Constitution when I make any decisions. Nothing is prejudged.
After the U.S. Supreme Court struck down Roe v. Wade, we have the 1849 ban on most abortions in effect in Wisconsin. There's a lawsuit, though, the state justice department saying, hang on, there's a 1980s law, and they're in conflict with each other. How would you weigh the older law versus the newer law?
You know, basically, I can't make any specific comments as to what I would do when elected as a Supreme Court justice. And what I've told people in regard to the abortion law, in regard to the 1849 law, I've been very, very clear that, again, my values are that women have the right to choose. I've stated that I disagreed with the Supreme Court's decision on this. And quite frankly, I was surprised when the United States Supreme Court decided to take away a fundamental right that so many people in our country had for such a long time. I'd also say that this is the same type of decision-making that people are tired of. They're really tired of. They don't want that from our Wisconsin Supreme Court. So, you know, we currently have a majority on the court who are making decisions based on right-wing partisan beliefs, not the Constitution and not the law. We need to bring that change back to the courts. We need to get away from that right-wing extremism and back to common sense.
I'm asking the candidates for the court about collegiality on the court. If you're criticizing current rulings as right-wing extremism, would you be able to have a collegial relationship with, if elected, your fellow judges?
Of course. You know, people disagree on different issues. They agree on ways to analyze different issues. It doesn't mean that you can't be collegial with them. You know, I have lots of friends on all ends of the political spectrum. And, you know, we like to have spirited debates and spirited conversations about the issues. So I don't anticipate that being an issue at all.
Talking to Janet Protasiewicz, Milwaukee County Circuit Court Judge, one of the candidates for Wisconsin's open state Supreme Court seat, a primary election coming up. Recusal. Sometimes judges are asked by parties to remove themselves from a case. What is your standard, or what would be your standard as a state Supreme Court justice, of when, it's rare, but when to recuse yourself from a particular case?
Well, I think there needs to be a recusal rule. I have been very, very open about that. And, you know, just what the standard and what the contribution limit needs to be in order to have someone recuse themselves, I think that there needs to be a public hearing. I think the public absolutely needs to weigh in on that. But I really, really believe a recusal rule is appropriate, you know, for lots of reasons. You know, other candidates have opposed, you know, additional rules. I think that's wrong. You know, I will obviously follow any recusal rule. But there are people who really believe that, you know, so much money is being poured into these races and so much of it by outside groups. Should a Supreme Court justice really sit on a case where, you know, millions of dollars of outside money has, you know, come in on your behalf? And I don't think that people think that's fair. I think that people think that that puts a thumb on the scale. So I think we need a recusal rule. I plan to follow that recusal rule, and I hope that that is determined by a, you know, public hearing on the matter.
A court race is a strange kind of race in the American political system. Usually you're voting for politicians to enact certain policies or not. How would you invite voters to weigh the decisions they make when voting for a judge at any level?
Well, I think you have to look at the person's judicial philosophy, you know, how they plan to run their courtroom, how they plan to treat people, whether or not they are, you know, able to be fair and appropriate under, you know, all circumstances. You know, judicial philosophy, you know, it's critical. Like I tell people, I can't tell you where I'm going to end up on a case, but I can tell you I'm going to root my decisions in the law. And so I go back to that change in common sense theme that I've been talking about, that we need to get away from hyper-partisanship and predetermined outcomes by ideologues. And, you know, we absolutely need to do that. You know, the Supreme Court should be, you know, different in many instances than the other branches of government. You know, people should really, really be able to look up to our Supreme Court and believe that it is a bastion of dignity and integrity and that they are going to have a fair shake, you know, across the board in our courts. So, you know, I think that it is critically, critically important that we get back to those values.
You've talked some about your judicial philosophy. Can you talk more about how you'd like to see parties, plaintiffs, citizens treated by judges at all levels in the court?
Well, at all levels. And I'll tell you, you know, I handled a domestic violence calendar for over a year. And I looked at the victims of those cases. You know, we would set those jury trials for either 8:30 or 9 in the morning. And I knew, you know, the victims were, you know, dropping off kids at school, that they had, you know, transportation issues. I knew defendants had transportation issues. And we always tried to be really attuned to that so that people really felt like they were respected across the board. We have an open, welcoming courtroom, and, you know, everybody's treated fairly. Nothing's predetermined. Decisions are rooted in law. People are all treated with respect.
We'll leave it there. Judge Protasiewicz, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That's Janet Protasiewicz, a Milwaukee County Circuit Court judge, one of four candidates running for a seat on the state Supreme Court. Earlier, we heard from a former state Supreme Court Justice Daniel Kelly. Tomorrow at this time, we'll also talk to another one of the candidates, Dane County Judge Everett Mitchell. The primary election for the Supreme Court race is on February 21st. You can find information about registration and voting at myvote.wi.gov. That's .gov. And by the way, join WPR tonight at 8 for live coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address. President Joe Biden will deliver the address to a joint meeting of Congress. NPR has live special coverage of that speech and of the Republican Party's response. That's special coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address tonight at 8. You can listen live here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. And then tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, Kate and her guests break down that State of the Union address, looking at the domestic policy statements in it, the international issues as well, all the big issues facing the nation as addressed by the president and Republicans and the response from Congress. Then join Central Time tomorrow. We will also look at some of the political rhetoric. Did we hear bipartisan outreach or partisan line drawing? A lot of State of the Union coverage coming up on Wisconsin Public Radio. Listen to the live address tonight at 8. Then join us tomorrow on Central Time and tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Last week on the show, we listened back to a conversation about nerd culture and science fiction, fantasy, and comics and their roles in pop culture, plus their fans. We heard from a couple more of you along the way. Michael in Kaukauna says he was a sci-fi nerd back in high school in the 70s and was teased mercilessly, but he was not alone. He and a friend would play short clips from Star Trek episodes and be able to pick the episode they were from. And Sarah says you could be a nerd about anything. Her husband, for example, Sarah says, is a truck nerd who could talk for hours about his truck. It's about the time you put into it and the passion you get from it. Yeah, I think about that expanded concept of nerdery a lot. I also know a couple of car nerds in my life. Definitely know a lot of music nerds along the way. I'm borderline a music nerd myself. Here at Central Time, we even have a cheese nerd. So yeah, whatever you nerd out about, let your nerd flag fly. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Join WPR for special coverage of the 2023 State of the Union Address tonight at 8 here on Wisconsin Public Radio and at WPR.org. Now, if you're a home or business owner, you might have heard from Wisconsin's Focus on Energy program about incentives for making your home or facilities more energy efficient. Governor Tony Evers had previously asked for increased funding for the program by way of higher contributions from utilities as part of his 2021-23 budget proposal. Republican state lawmakers pulled that from the budget. It's unclear whether Evers will make a similar proposal this cycle, but increasing energy efficiency statewide is a part of the governor's plan to make Wisconsin's electricity 100% carbon-free by 2050. So how's the Focus on Energy program working in the meantime? You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the state's Focus on Energy efficiency program? Have you worked with it, benefited from it maybe as a private citizen or a business owner? Have you made changes to make your home or office more energy efficient? Have you seen an impact on your energy bills? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Rebecca Cameron Bach is chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. Rebecca, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, I mentioned people who are familiar with Focus on Energy, asking them to call in. How about for people who haven't? Can you give us the basics on what Focus on Energy is and what it does?
Sure. So Focus on Energy partners with Wisconsin utilities to help homeowners and businesses install cost-effective energy efficiency and renewable energy projects. What's really important, and I've heard this being discussed multiple times over the last few years, and I think that it's a point that is worth clarifying. When we're talking about energy efficiency, we're talking about using less energy to perform the same task in order to produce the same result. So energy efficient homes and buildings will use less energy to heat or cool or run appliances and electronics. And when we look at our manufacturing companies, energy efficient manufacturing facilities, they actually use less energy. So it's important to understand the difference between conservation and energy efficiency. When we talk about conservation, that's relying on people's individual behavior to cut back on their usage. When we're talking about energy efficiency and Focus on Energy in particular, we're talking about ways to harness and utilize technology to help us avoid or reduce energy waste.
Can you give us a couple of examples of the things that Focus on Energy might do, say with homeowners via utilities to help harness that that efficiency?
Sure, absolutely. So the first thing that Focus would help you do is they would take an energy assessment of your home. They would send out a trade ally. They would look at the home. They would measure. They would look at the doors. Are you losing a lot of air in between your door jams, in your windows? And then they would offer a range of rebates and services to help you make your home more efficient. So think everything from pipe insulation to Energy Star certified LED light bulbs, high efficiency shower heads, all sorts of products, insulation, air sealing, to help your home retain the energy inside so that it's not leaking energy, so to speak.
And I assume some of those things would apply in a business setting as well. What sorts of unique things for a business, and that can cover a lot of ground, obviously, what kind of specific things for the business world might Focus on Energy do?
Right, absolutely. I mean, we see just an incredible amount of savings when we look at the business applications, in particular in the manufacturing segment. There are ways and technologies that you can capture the wasted heat that comes off of, think of a very high intensity line where you're producing a product or you're heating metal to a really, really high temperature. You can capture the energy that's coming off from that, from that process, and you can reutilize the energy. But that takes technical expertise. And one of the real important benefits of Focus on Energy is the technical assistance and the technical advisors that they have. So they will work with manufacturing companies, large energy users, and help identify, walk around the facility, look at the shop floor, identify ways to capture those savings, and then run through the numbers to help make it as cost effective as possible.
Rebecca Cameron Bach is with us, chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission, looking at the state's Focus on Energy electricity efficiency program, energy efficiency in general, I should say. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, maybe your experiences. Have you done something to make your home or business more energy efficient? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Laura is with us in Twin Lakes. Hi, Laura.
Yeah, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm part of Citizen Climate Lobby out of Elkhorn, Wisconsin, And during our meeting last month, we talked about using focus on energy to promote the climate lobby and climate change and everything. And we also, we were talking about having it done, the assessment done, but I understand there may be a cost and it might be significant. Is that true? And
Scott, Laura, should, go ahead, Rebecca.
Yeah, thanks for the question. That should not be the case. The assessment should be able to be done at low to no cost. I'm assuming that you've already checked out focusonenergy.com.
I think yes. We do still have Laura. Yeah. So just in general, if somebody is in Laura's position, Rebecca, talk us through how they would seek out this home energy assessment.
So the best place to get started is to learn more by visiting our website, which is focusonenergy.com. And there you'll find a number of resources, particularly the ability to connect with a trade ally in your area of the state. And then you would work with that trade ally to determine what the next steps are.
Laura, thanks a lot for that call. Good luck. Rebecca, you've made the case recently that, hey, focus on energy is worth the investment and worth more investment. Republican lawmakers said, you know, the cost comes out of utilities who then pass the cost onto ratepayers. So how do you make the case that investing more is worth it?
So energy efficiency is one of the easiest and most cost-effective ways for us to do a number of things, including combating climate change, reducing energy costs for all consumers, and improving the competitiveness of our U.S. businesses. We also know through a number of studies that energy efficiency is arguably the most important component in achieving net zero emissions of carbon dioxide. For 2021, I can tell you, Rob, that the average residential customer paid about $1.78 per month. And by investing that $1.78 per month, Focus on Energy generated more than $4 in benefits. So what are those benefits? The benefits accrue to every single customer in the state, because we're reducing the kilowatt hours and the therms that are being consumed, which means that the utilities have to go out and procure less of that. By lowering peak demands, we are delaying or eliminating the need for costly grid investments, whether that's building new power plants or that's increasing construction activities that are needed on the distribution system. So it really truly is an investment in the truest sense of the word. And due to the continued success of Focus, Wisconsin homes and businesses have saved nearly 6.3 million megawatt hours since 2007. And to put that in terms that make it a little easier to understand, that is the same amount of generation that we would get from two modern large-scale natural gas plants. And that means real savings for all customers. And I've heard an argument that, well, if we're going to be increasing our investment in focus on energy, that's going to disproportionately impact the lower income communities of our state. And we know that that's not true. Because we know that energy efficiency programs actually improve community resilience, and energy efficiency programs address energy equity by bringing efficient and cost-effective technologies and infrastructure to underserved communities, those in our state which arguably have some of the most inefficient housing stock.
And you mentioned lower income people, Rebecca. I understand Focus of Energy works with, or the state has an energy assistance program. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So energy assistance is funded through the Department of Administration, and those are federal dollars that are used to help customers pay their energy bills. And certainly energy assistance is an important part of the equation when we're talking about energy burden or affordability of energy bills, but it is only one tool for us to use increased energy efficiency will help customers to utilize less energy, which will result in lower energy bills.
Rebecca, thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
That's Rebecca Cameron-Vock, chair of the Wisconsin Public Service Commission. We talked to her today about the state's energy efficiency program. It's called Focus on Energy. Coming up, we focus on the cost of heating your home, what drives the prices we pay, and ways you could be more efficient and save money while still staying warm. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen some sticker shock on your heating bills this year or in recent years? Have you done things, whether through Focus on Energy or otherwise, to try to conserve energy, to be more energy efficient, to bring those costs down? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our conversation about energy efficiency and turning toward home heating bills this winter. Carl Ebert recently wrote about the topic for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where he covers manufacturing, energy, and the new economy. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you noticed higher heating bills this year? We had a warmer than usual December, I think. Were you happy for some relief? Do you have questions about what goes into the prices we pay? Have you taken steps to pay less by getting more energy efficient, maybe some insulation? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Carl, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for having me.
You wrote this piece in January. As I mentioned, we had a, and you write in your piece, we had a milder start for the most part to the winter. What were you starting to look at as we hunkered down in some serious January cold?
Well, you know, that story stemmed from my bill, which had a couple of days of January in it. And I think that people were shocked by the scale of their December bills. Despite the fact that we had a mild winter, fuel costs were sky high in December, and that was reflected in what people paid.
And what's driving that cost in large part? I mean, a lot of us heat with natural gas, of course. What was happening with the price of natural gas?
Yeah, the majority of us heat with natural gas, and gas prices have been very volatile. For the past year, you know, it really began with the with the invasion of Ukraine. But global gas markets have been up and down. And by December, the price of gas, natural gas, was about 40% more than it is now.
And when I look, I actually follow natural gas prices some, and sometimes it's like, okay, great, the natural gas price just dropped a lot. That's not immediately reflected in our heating bills, which I guess makes sense. If I'm buying for utility, I'm not going to do like, oh, I'm running a little low on milk, I'll run out to the store today. How far in advance are they making sure they have a supply of natural gas?
Well, you know, that's one of the things that's hard for people to understand. If they do look at spot natural gas prices, there's a place in Louisiana called the Henry Hub, and that's the benchmark for current market prices. And you can see that go up and down and down. And it fell, but the utilities, you know, have a long-term fuel plan, and they need to establish reserves. They need to lock in contracts for the heating season, and then they supplement from the spot market. And this summer, when a lot of that buying happened, the prices were at the highest they've been in 2008, you know, a decade.
Mm-hmm. And you, in your piece, take us deep into our energy bills and a couple lines that up to our total, I guess, per unit of natural gas, called a therm, our per therm cost. What's going into that?
What's going into the per therm cost? The utilities are only allowed to bill us what they pay for the gas. The profit on the gas bill shows up in other charges other than the per therm charge. There are connection fees and other associated costs.
And with the fluctuations in price, which part of our heating bill do we see that show up on?
Typically your bill's going to have part of 1 month and part of the following month. You know, it's not like the billing period ends on the 30th or 31st of the month. So if you look at it and you want to kind of see where the prices are going, that'll show you as two separate lines. And then there is a base rate that you'll see. That was the one that was approved by the Public Service Commission as the very base. And then there's something that shows up as either a PGA or a purchase gas charge. It goes by a variety of names depending upon the utility. And that's what reflects the actual price of gas as it was paid for by the utility.
Talking to Carl Ebert with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at what goes into the price we pay to heat our homes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in a caller. Craig is with us in Adams. Craig, hi.
Hey, how you doing? I just want to back up and regroup just for a split second to your previous conversation. I'll jump right into the heat.
Sure.
All the new appliances out there are crap, okay? My mom has a kitchen stove, which is a Magic Chef from 1940 that still works. Our new stove lasted a year and a half, and our new fridge, which was a brand name, both only lasted 3 years, and then you're shopping again. Okay, now to the heat. We had to rebuild our house in 05 due to a fire. Everything, new house, new furnace, the whole thing. We are on our third motherboard for the furnace. Very, very brand name. Where parts are coming from, I don't care where it's manufactured, because that doesn't mean crap. Where the parts are coming from is not anywhere close to what it used to be.
I gotcha, Craig. Thanks a lot for the call. Carl, I mean, there's been a move toward more energy-efficient appliances. I got to say, I haven't had the bad luck. Craig has. Sorry about the house fire, too, Craig. Is there this perception out there that energy-efficient means shorter lifespans for these appliances? Is that anything you run into as you're researching furnaces?
No, boy, I really can't speak to that. I can from, the energy savings side,
sure,
say that, furnace maintenance is important. Changing filters is important. There are things that you can do. But my experience with a relatively new furnace is that I've got a significantly reduced heating bill and great reliability.
Craig, thanks again. Sorry for the bad appliance luck with you. Now, you also look, they say April's the cruelest month, Carl, but you asked the question, is January the worst month for home heating? I guess it kind of makes sense. Is that when we pay our biggest heating bills?
Typically, yes. You know, I mean, the weather's so variable now that it's hard to say. It was 40 some degrees out today. You can't predict it, but historically, when you look at what are called heating degree days, January is the coldest month. It's also one of the longer ones, psychologically as well as on the calendar. So you can expect your January bill generally to be higher, but there's no guarantee. You can have a very cold February and the bill comes down.
And then when it comes to energy efficiency, how much control do we have over our own heating bills by doing some of the, focus on energy kind of things we were talking about earlier? Can we bring those numbers down?
Well, yeah, certainly you can, and they're really simple things that you can do. You know, I spoke about, furnace maintenance. That one's maybe a little late in the season to be able to get somebody to do that, but, checking your filters. You can open south-facing windows during the day. That lets the heat in. It can raise the temperature.
The blinds, I should say, not the windows.
Right. Yeah, don't open the windows. I found that I have a house that has cold pockets. I have the fans on in winter, but I've reversed their direction from summer, and it moves the air around and it fills those things in. You can go through your windows, you can identify leaks, make those seals. All those things can make a difference.
And then you also wrote about a couple options for people having trouble paying their bills. We talked a little bit about the low-income heating assistance program earlier. There's also a budget billing that doesn't actually save money, but it does do something. What is that?
What it does is it evens out the peaks and valleys in your annual utility bill. And this is for both heat and for electric. And, in summer, a lot of us are running air conditioners, so the electric bill goes up. The if you sign up for budget billing, they look at the average that you've your average consumption over a fixed period, and then you sign up for 6 months and it gets adjusted, but you have a fixed bill every month that allows you to budget around that.
Carl, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Carl Ebert, business reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. We talked to him today about winter heating bills, how prices are set, and got some ideas on how we can try to save some money on those bills. We also heard earlier from the head of the state's Public Service Commission, Rebecca Cameron Vock, talking about the Focus on Energy program. We'll get a link to the Focus on Energy program, by the way, over at WPR.org/Central Time if you want to check it out and see if it applies to your home or your business. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we protect our rights often in the United States, but do we live up to our responsibilities, our obligations? We'll talk to the author of the new book, The Bill of Obligations, The 10 Habits of Good Citizens. We'll continue our series of interviews with the candidates for the open seat on Wisconsin's state Supreme Court, plus a look back at tonight's State of the Union address. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a federal appeals court overturned a federal law that prevents people from owning firearms while under a restraining order for domestic violence. We'll talk to a gun law expert about how a recent Supreme Court ruling is leading to legal challenges like this one. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.